he told her. But do remember that the speed of the bureaucratic machine makes British Rail look like Concord. The Labour government struggled on through a session dubbed by the press as the Winter of Discontent, trying to push bills through the House, losing a clause here and a clause there. Raymond was only too delighted to have reached the recess in one piece. Raymond spent a cold Christmas in Leeds with Joyce. He returned to London early in the new year, aware it could not be long before the Conservatives felt assured enough to put down a motion of no confidence. When it eventually was tabled, no one in Parliament was surprised. The debate caused a day of intense excitement, not least because a strike had caused the Commons bars to run dry, and thirsty members were huddled together in the lobbies, the tea room, the smoking room, and the dining rooms. Harassed whips rushed hither and thither, checking lists, ringing up hospitals, boardrooms, and even great aunts in their efforts to track down the last few elusive members. When Mrs. Thatcher rose on the 6th of April to address a packed House, the tension was so electric that the Speaker had considerable difficulty keeping control of the overcharged conductors. She addressed the House in firm, strident tones, which brought her own side to their feet when she resumed her place. The atmosphere was no different when it was the turn of the Prime Minister to reply. Both leaders made a gallant effort to rise above the petulance of their adversaries, but it was the Speaker who had the last word. "The ayes to the right, 311. The noes to the left, 310. The ayes have it. The ayes have it." Pandemonium broke out. Opposition members waved their order papers in triumph, knowing the Prime Minister would now have to call a general election. James Callaghan immediately announced the dissolution of Parliament, and after an audience with the Queen, Election Day was set for the 3rd of May, 1979. At the end of that momentous week, those few members left at Westminster were stunned by an explosion in the members' car park. Airy Neave, the shadow spokesman on Northern Ireland, had been blown up by Irish terrorists as he was driving up the exit ramp to leave the Commons. He died on his way to hospital. Members hurried back to their constituencies. Both Raymond and Andrew found it hard to escape from their departments at such short notice, but Charles and Simon were out in their respective high streets shaking hands with the voters by the morning following the Queen's proclamation. For 3 weeks, the arguments about who was competent to govern went back and forth. But on the 3rd of May, the British people elected their first woman Prime Minister and gave her party a majority of 43 in the Commons. Andrew's sixth election turned out to be his most unpleasant to date, and he was only glad that he had left Louise and Clarissa in London. Jock McPherson, still the SNP candidate, called him every name under the sun and added one or two new ones in the evening, while the Trotskyites, who had voted against him on the committee, proved no help when it came to gathering in the votes on Election Day. But the citizens of Edinburgh, knowing nothing of the committee's opinions, sent Andrew back to Parliament with a majority of 3,738. The Scottish Nationalist vote crumbled, leaving only two members in the House, and Jock McPherson back in Scotland. Raymond's vote in Leeds was slightly reduced, while Joyce won the office pool for predicting most accurately what her husband's majority would be. He was beginning to accept that she knew more about the constituency than he ever would. A few days later, when Raymond returned to London, Kate had never seen him so depressed, and decided to hold off telling him her own news, when he said, "God knows how many years it will be before I can be of some use again. You can spend your time in opposition making sure the government doesn't dismantle all your achievements. With a majority of 43, they could dismantle me if they wanted to," he told her. He placed the red leather box marked Secretary of State for Trade in the corner, next to the ones marked Minister of State at the Department of Trade and Parliamentary Under-Secretary at the Department of Employment. "They're only your first three," Kate tried to reassure him. Simon increased his majority at Pucklebridge to 19,461, notching up another record, after which he and Elizabeth spent the weekend in their cottage with the boys, waiting for Mrs. Thatcher to select her team. Simon was surprised when the Prime Minister phoned personally and asked if he could come up to see her in Downing Street. That was an honour usually afforded only to cabinet ministers. He tried not to anticipate what she might have in mind. He duly travelled up from the country and spent 30 minutes alone with the new Prime Minister. When he heard what Mrs. Thatcher wanted him to do, he was touched that she had taken the trouble to see him in person. She knew that no member ever found it easy to accede to such a request, but Simon accepted without hesitation. Mrs. Thatcher added that no announcement would be made until he'd had time to talk his decision over with Elizabeth. Simon thanked her and travelled back to his cottage in Pucklebridge. Elizabeth sat in silence as she listened to Simon's account of his conversation with the Prime Minister. "Oh, my God," she said, when he'd finished. "She's offered you the chance to be a Minister of State, but in return we have no certainty of peace for the rest of our lives." "I can still say no," Simon assured her. "That would be the act of a coward," said Elizabeth, "and you've never been that." "Then I'll phone the Prime Minister and tell her I accept." "I ought to congratulate you," she said, "but it never crossed my mind for one moment." Charles was one of the few Tory seats in which the majority went down. A missing wife is hard to explain, especially when it's common knowledge that she's living with the former chairman of the adjoining constituency. Charles had faced a certain degree of embarrassment with his local committee, and he made sure that the one woman who couldn't keep her mouth shut was told his version of the story in strictest confidence. Any talk of removing him had died when it was rumoured that Charles would stand as an independent candidate if replaced. When the vote was counted, Sussex Downs still returned Charles to Westminster with a majority of 20,176. He sat alone in Eaton Square over the weekend, but no one contacted him. He read in the Monday Telegraph, how he missed the Times, the full composition of the new Tory team. The only surprise was Simon Carslake's appointment as Minister of State for Northern Ireland.
This ends side 2 of cassette 7 of First Among Equals. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 8. First Among Equals, cassette 8.
Chapter 24. "Well, say something." "Very flattering, Kate. What reason did you give for turning the offer down?" asked Raymond, who had been surprised to find her waiting for him at the flat.
"I didn't need a reason."
"How did they feel about that?"
"You don't seem to understand. I accepted their offer."
Raymond removed his glasses and tried to take in what Kate was saying. He steadied himself by holding on to the mantelpiece. Kate continued.
"I had to, darling."
"Because the offer was too tempting?"
"No, you silly man. It had nothing to do with the offer as such, but it gives me the chance to stop letting my life drift. Can't you see it was because of you?"
"Because of me, you're going to leave London and go back to New York?"
"To work in New York and start getting my life in perspective. Raymond, don't you realize it's been 5 years?
"I know how long it is and how many times I've asked you to marry me."
"We both know that that isn't the answer. Joyce can't be brushed aside that easily. And it could even end up being the single reason you fail in your career."
"We can overcome that problem, given time," Raymond reasoned.
"That sounds fine now, until the party wins the next election and lesser men than you are offered the chance to shape future policy. Can't I do anything to make you change your mind?
Nothing, my darling. I've handed Chase my resignation and begin my new job with Chemical Bank in a month.
Only 4 weeks, said Raymond.
Yes. 4 weeks.
I had to hold off telling you until I had severed all the bonds, had resigned, and could be sure of not letting you talk me out of it.
Do you know how much I love you?
I hope enough to let me go before it's too late.
Charles would not have normally accepted the invitation. Lately, he'd found cocktail parties to consist of nothing but silly little bits of food, never being able to get the right drink, and rarely enjoying the trivial conversation. But when he glanced on his mantelpiece and saw an at-home from Lady Carrington, he felt it might be an amusing break from the routine he'd fallen into since Fiona had left. He was also keen to discover more about the rumoured squabbles in Cabinet over expenditure cuts. He checked his tie in the mirror, removed an umbrella from the hatstand, and left Eaton Square for Ovington Square. He and Fiona had been apart for nearly 2 years. Charles had heard from several sources that his wife had now moved in with Dalgleish on a permanent basis, despite his unwillingness to cooperate over a divorce. He had remained discreetly silent on his wife's new life, except for one or two selected titbits dropped selectively in the ears of well-chosen gossips. That way he had elicited for himself sympathy from every quarter, while remaining the magnanimous, loyal husband. Charles had spent most of his spare time in the Commons, and his most recent budget speech had been well received both by the House and the national press. During the committee stage of the finance bill, he had allowed himself to be burdened with a lot of the donkey work. Clive Reynolds had been able to point out discrepancies in some clauses of the bill, which Charles passed on to a grateful Chancellor. Thus Charles received praise for saving the government from any unnecessary embarrassment. At the same time, he disassociated himself from the wets, as the Prime Minister referred to those of her colleagues who did not unreservedly support her monetarist policies. If he could keep up his work output, he was confident he would be preferred in the first reshuffle. By spending his mornings at the bank and afternoons and evenings in the Commons, Charles managed to combine both worlds with the minimum of interruption from his almost non-existent private life. He arrived at Lord Carrington's front door a little after 6:45. A maid answered his knock, and he walked straight through to a drawing room that could have held 50 guests, and very nearly did. He even managed to be served with the right blend of whisky before joining his colleagues from both the upper and lower houses. He saw her first, over the top of Alec Pimpkin's balding head. "Who is she?" asked Charles, not expecting Pimpkin to know.
"Amanda Wallace," said Pimpkin, glancing over his shoulder. "I could tell you a thing or two."
But Charles had already left his colleague in mid-sentence. The sexual aura of the woman was attested to by the fact that she spent the entire evening surrounded by attentive men, like moths around a candle. If Charles had not been one of the tallest men in the room, he might never have seen the flame. It took him another 10 minutes to reach her side of the room, where Julian Ridsdale, a colleague of Charles in the Commons, introduced them, only to find himself dragged away moments later by his wife. Charles was left staring at a woman who would have looked beautiful in anything from a ball gown to a towel. Her slim body was encased in a white silk dress, and her fair hair touched her bare shoulders. But what struck Charles most was the translucent texture of her skin. It had been years since he had found it so hard to make conversation.
"I expect you already have a dinner engagement," Charles asked her in the brief intervals before the vultures closed in again.
"No," she replied, and smiled encouragingly. She agreed to meet him at Walton's in an hour's time. Charles dutifully began to circulate round the room, but it was not long before he found his eyes drawn back to her. Every time she smiled, he found himself responding. But Amanda didn't notice, because she was always being flattered by someone else. When he left an hour later, he smiled directly at her, and this time did win a knowing grin. Charles sat alone in a corner table at Walton's for another hour. He was just about to admit defeat and return home when she was ushered to the table. The anger that had developed from being kept waiting was forgotten the moment she smiled and said, "Hello, Charlie." He was not surprised to learn that his tall, elegant companion earned her living as a model. As far as Charles could see, she could have modelled anything from toothpaste to stockings. "Shall we have coffee at my place?" Charles asked, after an unhurried dinner. She nodded her assent, and he called for the bill, not checking the addition for the first time in many years. He was delighted, if somewhat surprised, when she rested her head on his shoulder in the cab on the way back to Eaton Square. By the time they had been dropped off at Eaton Square, most of Amanda's lipstick had been removed. The cabbie thanked Charles for his excessive tip and couldn't resist adding, "Good luck, sir." Charles never did get round to making the coffee. When he woke in the morning, to his surprise, he found her even more captivating, and for the first time in weeks, quite forgot yesterday in Parliament. Elizabeth listened carefully as the man from Special Branch explained how the safety devices worked. She tried to make Peter and Michael concentrate on not pressing the red buttons that were in every room and would bring the police at a moment's notice. The electricians had already wired the rooms in Beaufort Street, and now they had nearly finished at the cottage. At Beaufort Street, a uniformed policeman stood watch by the front door night and day. In Paku Bridge, because the cottage was so isolated, they had to be surrounded by arc lamps that could be switched on at a moment's notice.
"It must be damned inconvenient," suggested Archie Milburn during dinner.
After his arrival at the cottage, he had been checked by security patrols with dogs before he was able to shake hands with his host.
"Inconvenient is putting it mildly," said Elizabeth.
"Last week, Peter broke a window with a cricket ball, and we were immediately lit up like a Christmas tree."
"Do you get any privacy?" asked Archie.
"Only when we're in bed. Even then you can wake up to find you're being licked. You sigh, and it turns out to be an Alsatian." Archie laughed.
"Lucky Alsatian."
Every morning when Simon was driven to work, he was accompanied by two detectives, a car in front and another to the rear. He had always thought there were only two ways from Beaufort Street to Westminster. For the first 21 days as minister, he never travelled the same route twice. Whenever he was due to fly to Belfast, he was not informed of either his departure time or from which airport he would be leaving. While the inconvenience drove Elizabeth mad, the tension had the opposite effect on Simon. Despite everything, it was the first time in his life he didn't feel it was necessary to explain to anyone why he had chosen to be a politician. Inch by inch, he worked to try to bring the Catholics and Protestants together. Often, after a month of inches, he would lose a yard in one day, but he never displayed any anger or prejudice, except perhaps, as he told Elizabeth, a prejudice for common sense. Given time, Simon believed a breakthrough would be possible, if only he could find on both sides a handful of men of goodwill. During the all-party meetings, both factions began to treat him with respect and privately with affection. Even the opposition spokesman at Westminster openly acknowledged that Simon Carslake was turning out to be an excellent choice for the dangerous and thankless ministry. Andrew also knew he would require a handful of men of goodwill when Hamish Ramsay resigned as chairman of Edinburgh Carlton.
"I don't need the hassle any longer," Hamish told him.
I'm not in politics for the same reason as that bunch of troublemakers. Andrew reluctantly let him go, and had to work hard to convince Hamish's deputy, David Connaught, that he should stand in his place. When David finally agreed to allow his name to go forward, he was immediately opposed by Frank Boyle, who had already made his opinion of the sitting member abundantly clear. Andrew canvassed every person on the committee during the run-up to the election for the new chairman. He estimated the voting was going to be 7-7, which would still allow Hamish to give his casting vote in favour of Connaught. Andrew phoned Hamish at home an hour before the meeting was due to begin.
"I'll call and leave a message for you at the house when it's all over," Ramsay told him. "Don't worry. You're safe this time. At least I'll leave you with the right chairman."
Andrew left Pelham Crescent after he had tucked Clarissa up in bed and read her another chapter of Jacob Tutu. He told Louise he would return from Westminster straight after the 10 o'clock vote. He sat in the chamber and listened to Charles Seymour deliver a well-argued discourse on monetarist policy. Andrew didn't always agree with the logic of Seymour's case, and he had never much cared for the man himself. But he had to admit that such talent was wasted on the back benches. During the speech, a note was passed to Andrew by an attendant. He unfolded the little white slip. Stuart Gray, the lobby correspondent for the Scotsman, needed to speak to him urgently. Andrew slipped from his place on the front bench, stepping over the feet of shadow ministers, still intent on Seymour's speech. He felt like a small boy leaving a cinema in the middle of a film in pursuit of an ice lolly. He found Gray waiting for him in the members' lobby. Andrew had known Stuart since he had first entered the House, when the journalist had told him, "You and I are each other's bread and butter, so we'd better make a sandwich." Andrew had laughed, and they had had few differences of opinion in the 15 years since. Stuart suggested that they go down to Annie's bar for a drink. They strolled along the corridor and took the stairway near the tea room to the basement bar named after a former bar lady. Andrew settled down on a couch at the side of a pillar, while Stuart went up to the bar to order two whiskies. "Cheers," said the journalist, putting Andrew's glass down on the table in front of him. Andrew took a long gulp.
"Now, what can I do for you?" he asked. "Is my father being tiresome again?"
"I'd call him a supporter compared with your new chairman."
"What do you mean? I've always found David Connaught to be a sound fellow myself," said Andrew a little pompously.
"I'm not interested in your views of David Connaught," said Stuart. "I want an opinion on your new chairman, Frank Boyle." The journalist sounded very much on the record.
"What?"
"He won the vote tonight, 7-6.
But..."
Andrew fell silent.
"Come on, Andrew. We both know the bloody man's a commie troublemaker, and my editor is screaming for a quote."
"I can't say anything, Stuart. Not until I know all the facts."
"I've just told you all the facts. Now, are you going to give me a quote?"
"Yes." Andrew paused. "I'm sure Mr. Boyle will continue to serve in the best traditions of the Labour Party, and I look forward to working in close cooperation with him."
"Balls," said Stuart. "They'll only print that in Sood's Corner in Private Eye."
"It's the only quote you're going to get out of me tonight," said Andrew. Stuart looked at his friend and could see lines on his face that he had never noticed before.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I went too far. Please, get in touch when the time's right. With that bastard Boyle in charge, you might be in need of my help."
Andrew thanked him absent-mindedly, downed his whiskey in one gulp, then walked out of Annie's bar and along the terrace corridor to the phone booths at the foot of the stairs. He dialed Ramsay's home number.
"What in heaven's name happened?" was all he could ask.
"One of our voters didn't show," said Hamish Ramsay. "Claimed he was held up in Glasgow and couldn't get back in time. I was just about to ring you."
"Bloody irresponsible of him," said Andrew.
"Why didn't you postpone the vote?"
"I tried to, but Frank Boyle produced the rule book. Any motion proposed 14 days before a meeting cannot be postponed without the agreement of the proposer and the seconder. I'm sorry, Andrew. My hands were tied. It's not your fault, Hamish. I couldn't have had a better chairman than you. I'm only sorry you didn't leave in a blaze of glory. Hamish chuckled. Don't you ever forget, Andrew, the voters have the last word in a democracy. In Edinburgh, you're the man who has served them for more than 15 years, and they won't forget that quickly. You can get dressed now, Miss Wallace, said the gynecologist, returning to her desk. Amanda started to slip back into her latest Dior outfit, a light blue denim suit bought the previous day in Conduit Street, in an attempt to cheer herself up. It's the third time in 5 years, said Elizabeth Karslake, leafing through the confidential file and trying not to sound accusing. I may as well book into the same clinic as before, said Amanda, matter-of-factly. Elizabeth was determined to make her reconsider the consequences. Is there any chance that the father would want you to have this child? I can't be certain who the father is, said Amanda, looking shamefaced for the first time. You see, it was the end of one relationship and the beginning of another. Elizabeth made no comment other than to say, I estimate that you're at least 8 weeks pregnant, but it could be as much as 12. She looked back down at the file. Have you considered giving birth to the child and then bringing it up yourself? Good heavens, no, said Amanda. I make my living as a model, not as a mother. So be it. Elizabeth sighed, closing the file. I'll make all the... She avoided saying usual. Necessary arrangements. You must see your GP immediately and ask him to sign the required clearance forms. Then phone me in about a week, rather than make the trip down to Parklebridge again. Amanda nodded her agreement. Could you let me know what the clinic is going to charge this time? I'm sure they're suffering from inflation like the rest of us. Yes, I'll look into that, Miss Wallace, said Elizabeth, just managing to keep her temper as she showed Amanda to the door. Once her patient had left, Elizabeth picked up the confidential file from her desk, walked over to the cabinet, and flicked through STU until she found the right slot. Perhaps she should have been sterner with her, but she was convinced that it would have made little difference. She paused, wondering if having the child might change the woman's cavalier attitude to life. Charles returned home after the debate, feeling pleased with himself. He had received praise for his latest speech from every wing of the party, and the Chief Whip had made it quite clear that his efforts on the finance bill had not gone unnoticed. As he drove back to Eaton Square, he wound down the car window and let the fresh air rush in and the cigarette smoke out. His smile widened at the thought of Amanda sitting at home waiting for him. It had been a glorious couple of months. At 48, he was experiencing realities he had never even dreamed of in fantasy. As each day passed, he expected the infatuation to wear off, but instead, it only grew more intense. Even the memory the day after was better than anything he had experienced in the past. Once the Holbein had been restored to his dining room wall, Charles planned to talk to Amanda about their future. If she said yes, he would even be willing to grant Fiona a divorce. He parked the car and took out his latchkey, but she was already there, opening the front door to throw her arms around him. Why don't we go straight to bed? She greeted him. Charles would have been shocked had Fiona uttered such feelings, even once in their 15 years of married life. But Amanda made it appear quite natural. She was already lying naked on the bed before Charles could get his waistcoat off. After they'd made love, and she was settled in his arms, Amanda told him she would have to go away for a few days. Why? Said Charles, puzzled. I'm pregnant, she said matter-of-factly. I've already booked myself into a clinic. Don't worry, I'll be as right as rain in no time. But why don't we have the baby? Said the delighted Charles, looking down into her grey eyes.
I've always wanted a son. Don't be silly, Charlie. There's years ahead of me for that. But if we were married... You're already married. Besides, I'm only 26. I can get a divorce in a moment, and life wouldn't be so bad with me, would it? Of course not, Charlie. You're the first man I've ever really cared for. Charles smiled hopefully. So you will think about the idea. Amanda looked into Charles's eyes anxiously. If I were to have a child, I do hope he'd have blue eyes like yours. Will you marry me? He asked. I'll think about it. In any case, you may have changed your mind by morning.
Raymond drove Kate to Heathrow. He was wearing the pink shirt she had chosen for him. She was wearing the little red box. He had so much to tell her on the way to the airport that she hardly spoke at all. The last 4 weeks had gone by in a flash. It was the first time he had been grateful for being in opposition.
It's all right, Carrot Top. Don't fuss. We'll see each other whenever you come to New York.
I've only been to America twice in my life, he said. She tried to smile. Once she had checked her 11 bags and at the counter, a process that seemed to take forever, she was allocated a seat. Flight BA-107, gate number 14, boarding in 10 minutes, she was informed.
Thank you, she said, and rejoined Raymond, who was sitting on the end of an already crowded tubular settee.
He had bought 2 plastic cups of coffee while Kate had been checking in. They were both already cold. They sat and held hands like children who had met on a summer holiday and had now to return to separate schools.
Promise me you won't start wearing contact lenses the moment I've gone.
Yes, I can promise you that, said Raymond, touching the bridge of his glasses.
I've so much I still want to tell you, she said.
He turned towards her.
Vice presidents of banks shouldn't cry, he said, brushing a tear from her cheek. The customers will realize you're a soft touch.
Neither should cabinet ministers, she replied. All I wanted to say is that if you really feel...
She began.
Hello, Mr. Gould!
They both looked up to see a broad smile spread across the face of someone whose tan proved that he had just arrived from a sunnier climate.
I'm Bert Cox, he said, thrusting out his hand. I don't suppose you remember me.
Raymond let go of Kate's hand and shook Mr. Cox's.
We were at the same primary school in Leeds, Ray. Mind you, that was a million light years ago. You've come a long way since then.
How can I get rid of him? Wondered Raymond desperately.
This is the missus.
Bert Cox continued obliviously, gesturing at the silent woman in a flowery dress by his side. She smiled, but didn't speak.
She sits on some committee with Joyce, don't you, love?
He said, not waiting for her to reply. This is the final call for flight BA-107, now boarding at gate number 14.
We always vote for you, of course, continued Bert Cox. The missus, he pointed to the lady in the flowered dress again, thinks you'll be Prime Minister. I always say...
I must go, Raymond, said Kate, or I'll miss my flight.
Can you excuse me for a moment, Mr. Cox, said Raymond.
Delighted. I'll wait. I don't often get a chance to have a word with my MP.
Raymond walked with Kate towards the barrier.
I'm sorry about this. I'm afraid they're all like that in Leeds. Hearts of gold, but never stop talking.
What were you going to say?
Only that I would have been happy to live in Leeds, however cold it is. I never envied anyone in my life, but I do envy Joyce.
She kissed him gently on the cheek and walked towards the barrier before he could reply. She didn't look back.
Are you feeling all right, madam?
Asked an airport official as she went through the security barrier.
I'm fine,
said Kate, brushing aside her tears. She walked slowly towards gate 14 happy that he had worn the pink shirt for the first time. She wondered if he had found the note she had left underneath the collar. If he had asked her just one more time. Raymond stood alone, and then turned to walk aimlessly towards the exit.
An American lady, I would have guessed, said Mr. Cox, rejoining him. I'm good on accents.
Yes, said Raymond, still alone.
A friend of yours?
He asked. My best friend, said Raymond. When 10 days had passed, and Elizabeth had not yet heard from Miss Wallace, she decided she had no choice but to contact her direct. She flicked through her personal file and noted the latest number Amanda had given. Elizabeth picked up the phone and dialed. It was some time before anybody answered.
730-9712. Charles Seymour speaking.
There was a long silence.
Is anyone there?
Elizabeth couldn't reply. She replaced the receiver and felt her whole body come out in a cold sweat. She closed Amanda Wallace's file and returned it to the cabinet. Chapter 25. Simon had spent nearly a year preparing a white paper entitled A Genuine Partnership for Ireland, for consideration by the House. The government's aim was to bring North and South together for a period of 10 years, at the end of which a more permanent arrangement could be considered. During those 10 years, both sides would remain under the direct rule of Westminster and Dublin. Both Protestants and Catholics had contributed to the Charter, as the press had dubbed the complex agreement. With considerable skill, patience, and fortitude, Simon had convinced the political leaders of Northern Ireland to append their names to the final draft when and if it was approved by the House. He admitted to Elizabeth that the agreement was only a piece of paper, but he felt it was a foundation stone on which the House could base an eventual settlement. On both sides of the Irish Sea, politicians and journalists alike were describing the Charter as a genuine breakthrough. The Secretary of State for Northern Ireland was to present the white paper to the Commons when Irish business was next scheduled on the parliamentary calendar. Simon, as the architect of the Charter, had been asked to deliver the winding-up speech on behalf of the government. He knew that if the House backed the concept of the document, he might then be allowed to prepare a parliamentary bill, and thus overcome a problem so many other politicians had failed to solve before him. If he succeeded, Simon felt that all the sacrifices he had made in the past would prove worthwhile. When Elizabeth sat down to read through the final draft in Simon's study that evening, even she admitted for the first time that she was pleased he had accepted the Irish appointment. "Now, embryonic statesman," she continued, "are you ready for your dinner like every normal human being at this time of the evening?" "I certainly am." Simon moved his copy of the 129-page charter from the dining room table to the sideboard, planning to go over it yet again once he'd finished dinner. "Damn," he heard Elizabeth say from the kitchen. "What is it?" he asked, not looking up from his toy, like a child studying a jigsaw and wondering where a colourless piece fitted in. "I'm out of Bisto." "I'll go and buy some," Simon volunteered. The two policemen on the door were chatting when the minister came out. "Come on, my wife needs a packet of Bisto, so affairs of state must be held up for the time being."
"I'm very sorry, sir," said the sergeant. "When I was told you'd be in for the rest of the evening, I allowed the official car to go off duty. But Constable Barker can accompany you."
"Well, that's no problem," said Simon. "We can take my wife's car. I'll just find out where she's parked the damn thing."
He slipped back into the house, but returned a moment later.
"Been in the force long?"
he asked Constable Barker, as they walked down the road together.
"Not that long, sir. Started on the beat just over a year ago."
"Are you married, Constable?"
"Fine chance on my salary, sir,"
then you won't have encountered the problem of being bistoless.
They never heard of gravy in the police canteen, sir.
You should try the House of Commons sometime, said Simon. I don't think you'd find it any better. The food, that is. Not to mention the salary.
The two men laughed as they headed off toward the car.
What does your wife think of the mini-metro?
The constable asked as Simon put the key in the door.
Like everyone else in Beaufort Street, Elizabeth heard the explosion, but she was the first to realize what it had to be. She ran out of the front door in search of the duty policeman. She saw him running down the road and quickly followed. The little red metro was scattered all over the side street, the glass from its windows making the pavement look as though there'd been a sudden hailstorm. When the sergeant saw the severed head, he pulled Elizabeth back. Two other bodies lay motionless in the road. One of them, an old lady with the contents of her shopping bag spread around her. Within minutes, six police cars had arrived, and special branch officers had cordoned off the area with white ribbon. An ambulance rushed the bodies to Westminster Hospital. The job of picking up the remains of the police constable needed a very resolute man. Elizabeth was taken to the hospital in a police car, where she learned that the old lady had died before arrival, while her husband was on the critical list. When she told the surgeon in charge that she was a doctor, he was more forthcoming and answered her questions candidly. Simon was suffering from multiple fractures, a dislocated hip, and a severe loss of blood. The only question he was not willing to be drawn on was when she asked about his chances. She sat alone outside the operating theatre, waiting for any scrap of news. Hour after hour went by, and Elizabeth kept recalling Simon's words. Be tolerant. Always remember, there are still men of goodwill in Northern Ireland. She found it almost impossible not to scream, to think of the whole lot of them as evil murderers. Her husband had worked tirelessly on their behalf. He wasn't a Catholic or a Protestant, just a man trying to do an impossible task. Although she couldn't help thinking that it was she who had been the intended target. Another hour passed. A tired, grey-faced man came out into the corridor through the flapping rubber doors.
You're still hanging on, Dr. Karslake. Your husband has the constitution of an ox. Most people would have let go by now.
He smiled.
Can I find you a room so that you can get some sleep?
No, thank you,
Elizabeth replied.
I'd prefer to be near him.
She rang home to check the children were coping, and her mother answered the phone. She had rushed over the moment she had heard the news and was keeping them away from the radio and television.
How is he?
She asked. Elizabeth told her mother all she knew, then spoke to the children.
We're taking care of Grandmother,
Peter told her. Elizabeth couldn't hold back the tears.
Thank you, darling,
she said, and quickly replaced the receiver. She returned to the bench outside the operating theatre, kicked off her shoes, curled her legs under her body, and tried to snatch some sleep. She woke with a start in the early morning. Her back hurt and her neck was stiff. She walked slowly up and down the corridor in her bare feet, stretching her aching limbs, searching for anyone who could tell her some news. Finally, a nurse brought her a cup of tea and assured her that her husband was still alive. But what did still alive mean? She stood and watched the grim faces coming out of the operating theatre and tried not to recognize the telltale signs of despair. The surgeon told her she ought to go home and rest. They would have nothing to tell her for several hours. A policeman kept all journalists who were arriving by the minute in an anteroom off the main corridor. Elizabeth didn't move from the corridor for another day and another night, and she didn't return home until the surgeon told her it was all over. When she heard the news, she fell on her knees and wept. God must want the Irish problem solved as well, he added.
Your husband will live, Dr. Karslake. But it's a miracle.
Got time for a quick one? Asked Alexander Dalglish.
If you press me, said Pimpkin.
Fiona, shouted Alexander. It's Alec Pimpkin. He's dropped in for a drink. She came through to join them. She was dressed in a bright yellow frock and had allowed her hair to grow down past her shoulders.
It suits you, said Pimpkin, tapping his bald head.
Thank you, said Fiona. Why don't we all go through to the drawing room?
Pimpkin happily obeyed, and had soon settled himself into Alexander's favourite chair.
What will you have?
Asked Fiona as she stood by the drinks cabinet.
A large gin with just a rumour of tonic.
Well, how's the constituency faring since my resignation?
It ticks along, trying hard to survive the biggest sex scandal since Profumo, chuckled Pimpkin.
Only hope it hasn't harmed your election chances, said Alexander.
Not a bit of it, old fellow,
said Pimpkin, accepting the large beef-eaters and tonic Fiona handed him.
On the contrary, it's taken their minds off me for a change.
Alexander laughed.
In fact, continued Pimpkin, interest in the date of your wedding has only been eclipsed by Charles and Lady Di. Gossips tell me, he continued, clearly enjoying himself, that my honourable friend, the member for Sussex Downs, made you wait the full 2 years before you could place an announcement in the Times.
Yes, that's true, said Fiona. Charles didn't even answer my letters during that period, but lately, when any problems have arisen, he's been almost friendly.
Could that be because he also wants to place an announcement in the Times?
Said Pimpkin, downing his gin quickly in the hope of being offered a second.
What do you mean?
Well, the fact that he's lost his heart to another.
Another? Said Alexander Dalglish.
No less.
Pimpkin paused as he sipped pointedly at his empty glass.
Then Miss Amanda Wallace, only daughter of the late and little lamented Brigadier Boozer Wallace.
Amanda Wallace, said Fiona in disbelief. Surely he's got more sense than that.
I don't think it has a lot to do with sense,
said Pimpkin, holding out his glass.
More to do with sex.
But he's old enough to be her father.
If that is the case, said Pimpkin, Charles can always adopt her.
Alexander laughed.
But I am informed by a reliable source, continued Pimpkin, that marriage is being proposed.
You can't be serious, said Fiona flatly.
The subject has most certainly been broached, for she is undoubtedly pregnant, and Charles is hoping for a son,
said Pimpkin in triumph as he accepted his second double gin.
That's not possible, said Fiona under her breath.
And I'm also informed, continued Pimpkin, that some of the more ungenerous of our brethren are already suggesting the name of several candidates for the role of father.
Now, look, you're incorrigible.
My dear, it's common knowledge that Amanda has slept with half the cabinet and a considerable cross-section of bank benchers.
Stop exaggerating, said Fiona.
And what's more, continued Pimpkin, as if he hadn't heard her, she has only stopped short of the Labour front bench because her mother told her they were common and she might catch something from them.
Alexander laughed again. But surely Charles hasn't fallen for the pregnancy trick.
Hook, line and sinker. He's like an Irishman who's been locked into a Guinness brewery over the weekend. Dear Amanda has my honourable friend uncorking her at every opportunity.
But she's plain stupid, said Alexander. The only time I met her, she assured me that Michael Parkinson was turning out to be an excellent chairman of the party.
Stupid she may well be, said Pimpkin, but plain she is not, and together, I'm told, they're updating the Kama Sutra.
Enough, Alec, enough, said Fiona, laughing.
You're right,
said Pimpkin, aware that his glass was nearly empty once again.
A man of my impeccable reputation cannot afford to be seen associating with people living in sin. I must leave immediately, darlings,
he said, rising to his feet. Pimpkin put his glass down, and Alexander accompanied him to the front door. As it closed, Alexander turned to Fiona.
Never short of useful information, our former member, he said.
I agree, said Fiona. So much gleaned for such a small investment in beefeaters. As Alexander walked back into the drawing room, he added,
Does it change your plans for the return of the Holbein?
Not in any way, said Fiona.
So you'll still be at Sotheby's next week for their old master's sale?
Fiona smiled. Certainly. And if the price is right, we won't have to worry about what we give Charles for a wedding present.
Three weeks after the bombing, Simon left the Westminster Hospital on crutches, Elizabeth by his side. His right leg had been so shattered that he'd been told he would never walk properly again. As he stepped out onto Horse Ferry Road, 100 cameras flashed to meet their editor's demand to capture the instant hero. He smiled as if there were no pain. Don't let those murderers think they got you, he was warned by both sides. Elizabeth's smile showed only relief that her husband was still alive. After 3 weeks of complete rest, Simon returned to his Irish charter against doctor's orders, knowing the document was still due to be debated in the House in less than a fortnight. The Secretary of State and the other Minister of State for Northern Ireland visited him at home on several occasions, and it was agreed that the Minister of State would take over Simon's responsibilities temporarily and deliver the winding-up speech. During his absence, the whole Northern Ireland office grew to realize just how much work Simon had put into the charter, and no one was at all complacent about taking his place. The attempt on Simon's life and the build-up to the special debate on the charter became of such national interest that the BBC decided to broadcast the entire proceedings on Radio 4 from 3:30 to the vote at 10 o'clock. On the afternoon of the debate, Simon sat up in bed listening to every word on the radio as if it were the final episode in his favourite serial and he was desperate to know the outcome. The speeches opened with a clear and concise presentation of the charter by the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, which left Simon feeling confident that the whole House would support him. The opposition spokesman followed with a fair-minded speech, raising one or two queries he had over the controversial Patriots Clause, with its special rights for Protestants in the South and Catholics in the North, and also how it would affect the Catholics unwilling to register in Northern Ireland. Otherwise, he reassured the House that the opposition supported the Charter and would not be calling for a division.
This ends side one of cassette 8. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
Simon began to relax for the first time as the debate continued. But his mood changed as some backbench members started to express more and more anxiety over the Patriots' provision. One or two backbenchers were even insisting that the Charter should not be sanctioned by the House until the need for the Patriots' provision was fully explained by the government. Simon realized that a few narrow-minded men were simply playing for time in the hope the Charter would be held up and later forgotten. For generations, such men had succeeded in stifling the hopes and aspirations of the Irish people, while they allowed bigotry to undermine any real desire for peace. Elizabeth came in and sat on the end of the bed.
"How's it going?" she asked.
"Not well," said Simon. "It will all depend on the opposition spokesman."
They both sat and listened. But no sooner had the opposition spokesman risen that Simon realized that he too had misunderstood the real purpose of the Patriots' provision, and that what Simon had agreed to with both sides in Dublin and Belfast was not being accurately explained to the House. There was no malice in the speech, and he was clearly following what had been agreed through the usual channels, but Simon could sense that his lack of conviction was sowing doubts in the minds of his fellow members. He feared a division might be called after all. After one or two members had interrupted to voice further doubts about the Patriots Clause, the Shadow Minister suggested, "Perhaps we should wait until the Minister of State is fully recovered and able to report to the House himself." A few "hear, hears" could be heard around the chamber. Simon felt sick. He was going to lose the charter if it didn't get through the House tonight. All the hard work and goodwill would count for nothing. He made a decision. "I'd love a hot cup of cocoa," he said, trying to sound casual. "Of course, darling. I'll just go and turn the kettle on. Would you like a biscuit while I'm up?" Simon nodded. Once the bedroom door was closed, he slipped quietly out of bed and dressed as quickly as possible. He picked up his blackthorn stick, a gift from Dr. Fitzgerald, the Irish Prime Minister, which had been among the dozens of presents awaiting his return from hospital. Then he hobbled silently down the stairs and across the hall, hoping Elizabeth would not hear him. He eased the front door open. When the policeman on duty saw him, Simon put a finger to his lips and closed the door very slowly behind him. He made his way laboriously up to the police car, lurched into the back, and said, "Switch on the radio, please, and drive me to the House as quickly as possible." Simon continued to listen to the opposition spokesman as the police car weaved in and out of the traffic on a route he hadn't travelled before. They arrived at the St. Stephen's entrance to the Commons at 9:25. Visitors stood to one side as they might for royalty, but Simon didn't notice. He hobbled on through the central lobby, oblivious to the awkwardness of his gait, turning left past the policeman and on towards the entrance of the House. He prayed he would reach the chamber before the government spokesman rose to deliver his winding-up speech. Simon passed an astonished chief doorkeeper and arrived at the bar of the House as the new digital clock showed 9:29. The opposition spokesman was resuming his place on the front bench to muffled cries of "Hear, hear!" The Speaker rose, but before he had time to call upon the Minister of State to reply, Simon stepped slowly forward onto the green carpet of the Commons. For a moment, there was a stunned silence. Then the cheering began. It had reached a crescendo by the time Simon arrived at the front bench. His blackthorn stick fell to the floor as he clutched the dispatch box. The Speaker called out his name, sotto voce. Simon waited for the House to come to complete silence. "Mr. Speaker, I must thank the House for its generous welcome. I return this evening because, having listened to every word of the debate on the radio, I feel it necessary to explain to honourable members what was behind my thinking with the Patriots' provision. This was not some superficial formula for solving an intractable problem, but an act of good faith to which the representatives from all sides felt able to put their names. It may not be perfect, since words can mean different things to different people, as lawyers continually demonstrate to us." The laughter broke the tension that had been building up in the House. "But if we allow this opportunity to pass today, it will be another victory for those who revel in the mayhem of Northern Ireland, whatever their reason, and a defeat for all men of goodwill." The House was silent, as Simon went on to explain in detail the thinking behind the Patriots' provision and the effect it would have on both Protestants and Catholics in North and South. He also covered the other salient clauses in the Charter, answering the points that had been raised during the debate, until, in glancing up at the clock above the Speaker's chair, he realized he had less than a minute left. "Mr. Speaker, we in this great House, who have in the past decided the fate of nations, are now given an opportunity to succeed today where our predecessors have failed. I ask you to support this charter, not unreservedly, but to show the bombers and the murderers that here in Westminster we can cast a vote for the children of tomorrow's Ireland. Let the 21st century be one in which the Irish problem
is only a part of history. Mr. Speaker, I seek the support of the whole House. The motion on the charter